Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. We're taking your telephone calls, 410-662-8780. And the basic topic is disasters.
Yes. Right? Disaster in the kitchen.
It doesn't have to be disaster in the kitchen. We're not talking about the Titanic.
No, right.
But it's interesting. We're talking about this, and I'm thinking, why do people get in trouble? And we'll take your calls on other food and wine recommendations, how to fix a dinner party, travel destinations, any of the topics that are popular topics for a lot of our callers. But first and foremost,
there's just so many things that can go wrong in a kitchen. I mean, there's so much to learn to be a really good cook, and you know, if you aren't professional and doing it every day, you know, 10 hours a day, there's just, you know, if you're cooking every now and then, or maybe even cook every evening, it's there's so many different things you can try to make, and there are a lot of chances for failure, unfortunately.
Have you looked up a recipe recently online?
No, I never look up recipes.
And all of the accompanying videos and things, like if you want to, like, peel a potato, there are 7 videos for it.
No.
There was a video for coring a pineapple with an electric screwdriver.
Oh, my God. I would like to learn how to play the guitar, so maybe I'll look that up on the internet.
Yeah, I'm sure that you could learn a thousand ways, right?
Right,
so
YouTube.
I grabbed 2 favorite books just to, like, take a look at recipes, because I think recipes is where we get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
We understand the idea. We understand some of the words. We don't understand the language of cooking because we're not used to applying those words to those particular tasks that have to happen.
Right.
You know, creaming egg whites.
Right. Yeah, it's like, what does that mean?
I know cream.
Right.
I know egg whites.
But what does it mean to cream them? It's cooking terminology is, I mean, there's a reason why we go to culinary school.
Well, and the books that were written, you know, a long time ago, meaning 20, 30 years ago even, it's a lot of relatively anecdotal description of how to get stuff done in the kitchen. And if you don't know exactly what they mean, or you don't follow that writer's tone, you could be in big trouble.
Absolutely. As I was starting to say, you know, you go to culinary school to get a foundation upon which you build for the rest of your career, or you go and work for some very good chefs and you get a lot of experience, and you can learn that way, of course, to become a professional chef. But culinary school is so nice because they hit, you know, all these different areas, whether it's different types of cultures cooking, or different methods, or dealing with how to break down fish and butcher meats and make pasta and all these wonderful things. Granted, you only get to do it for maybe a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but at least you get to touch on it. And there's a very qualified chef in front of you answering all of your questions. You don't get that at home. At home, you're either on your own or you use a reference like the internet.
Let's take a call from our first caller, Mary in Baltimore. Mary, why don't you go ahead? You're live with Foreman and Wolf on WYPR.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, guys. Good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I was reading one of my favorite books last night called The Soul of a Chef.
Oh, yeah.
By Michael Ruhlman.
Uh-huh.
I love that book.
Me too.
And he was talking in a couple chapters about the time he spent with Thomas Keller and how Michael Ruhlman was just astounded at the care that Thomas Keller takes when cooking something as simple as green beans.
Absolutely.
Or asparagus. Or what has always been my challenge, fish.
Okay.
And he was talking about how Keller is so careful with the fish that he packs it in ice and then more ice and even stores it in the refrigerator in the same way that he thinks it was swimming in the ocean, which is way beyond what I would do. But I started thinking about how I always seem to mess up cooking a simple fish like flounder.
Okay.
So I was wondering if you guys could give me some tips about how to treat a soft flesh fish like that.
Sure.
And how to get the most flavor out of it.
Absolutely. I'd like to make 2 comments, actually. One thing, you've just hit on how to be a great cook, which is to have absolute respect for every single product you work with. And that's what we do. We try to find the very best products to get into the restaurant, fresh, beautiful, wherever they come from, that they're at their best.
If you're cooking for your family, it's the same thing.
I mean, it's
every step along the way. The reality is you only have X amount of time to get it done. So you may not be able to look up whether how to keep a salt water compartment in your refrigerator.
Well, and
so that you can store your fish swimming upstream in salt water.
But with cooking, say flounder. And because it tends to be, if you're going to probably have a small fillet, and it's going to cook very quickly. And one of the enemies of, well, first of all, the fish has to be extremely fresh. So again, we're talking about that respect of the product. So very, very fresh. You want it to smell like almost nothing, basically. It certainly shouldn't smell like very fishy or at all fishy. And you want the flesh, if it's filleted, it needs to be to spring back. It needs to be white. It shouldn't be discolored. And then it should be dry before it goes into a hot pan. And that's the case with a lot of things that you saute.
Which, and you just, Cindy, you just pat fish down
mm-hmm.
with a
paper towel.
A paper towel
just
or something.
Just to get the moisture off.
The other thing you have to pay great attention to is actually the relationship of the heat to the mm-hmm. flesh that you're about to cook. I mean, to the fish or the meat or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the pan being an appropriately heavy pan.
Right.
The interior of the pan being the right for the kind of fish
size.
That you're going to cook.
It has to be the right size,
and
the right pan.
It's got to be large enough.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone crowds pans.
If you crowd a pan, it reduces the heat too quickly, and that's why you don't sear well. So you want to have a pan that's the right size for the fish.
And it needs to have a heavy bottom to it.
Right.
My fish always seems to fall apart, my flounder.
You're overcooking
it.
That's because you're overcooking it. So the only way it would fall apart is by overcooking. So literally a piece of flounder, let's say it was an 8-ounce thin fillet. I mean, you can cook that in 2 to 3 minutes. How long are you cooking it?
Yeah, way longer than that.
Oh, yeah. That's why. Yeah, you literally, okay, so let's say you've got this gorgeous pan, nice heavy bottom pan. You get the pan hot. Then you drop the oil in. You could use corn oil. You could use peanut oil, any kind of canola oil, any sort of neutral oil. You want to coat the bottom of the pan, and there needs to be a little bit of extra fat when you tip it on the corner. So you certainly don't want it to come up any further than that. You put your dry piece of fish in the pan, you sear it on one side, you flip it over, and you're done. You're pretty well done. It's going to be literally like 3 minutes, maybe 4.
Things at home
I'm overcooking then.
Yes.
Things that home cooks don't do. Get your pan hot, but not smoking hot before you add your oil.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you add your oil, like Cindy said, you turn it around to make sure it coats and have a little more. A lot of cooks will like, you know, if I'm using a little less oil, there's going to be less fat in this dish. It's better for me.
No.
What will happen is things will stick.
Yeah. And then you'll have torn up fish.
Right.
And you won't have that beautiful
that's the
crust
other way
on the outside.
That it tears up. Mm-hmm. You want it to be slippery enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that pan needs to be hot. The oil needs to be hot, not smoking hot. Then the fish goes in nice and dry.
Mm-hmm. And if the fish can move the moment you put it in that pan, your pan is at the exact perfect temperature. If it sticks to the pan, it wasn't hot enough, or you don't have enough oil in the pan, or both.
Oh, great tip.
And
thank
also,
you.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, the other thing you said that I thought was so interesting is when you cook asparagus, which is one of my favorite vegetables, you mm-hmm. should always cook them standing up and treat them like flowers. Because he said a lot of people in this country, cook their asparagus pan-fried, or they roast them, and you get the most flavor out of them from cooking them standing up. So I'll get off. I'm sure there are other people, but if you could just comment on that, I'd be interested to hear what you said.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you
for calling in, Mary. With asparagus, and Mary was referring to also with green vegetables, any green vegetable you need. You certainly can cook them standing up, and there are specific asparagus pots for that, or you can tie the asparagus together. I will tell you that I do a large pot with lots of water and a good amount of salt, and much more than the size of the amount of asparagus, because what you need when you're boiling a green vegetable is for the pan to recover its boil as soon as possible, which means almost immediately. So when your pot should be boiling, well salted, and then you drop your product in, you know that that's either room temperature or cold product is going to drop the 212 degree boiling point down, and then it's going to come back up. And that's what I mean by recovering the temperature. And it needs to happen right away. So one, you lose less vitamins by cooking that way. And two, it just becomes bright green. It does its thing. It's cooked in just a short amount of time. And you're either ready to drain it, toss it in oil or butter or whatever you want to toss it in and season it. Or you, if you're doing it in a head or doing it for salad, you shock it immediately in ice water.
The difference between boiling asparagus and blanching asparagus is that result being bright green and crunchy versus being olive drab and mm-hmm. limp.
Yeah, which is a horrible thing to do to a vegetable for many reasons. Well, and the other thing, you know, when people are cooking, that recovery of the temperature of the pan, no matter if you're boiling water and blanching something, or you're sauteing something where you're trying to brown it, is that's why that pan can't be overcrowded. And and it's got to be hot enough, because basically you're kind of going to just be boiling it in its own little bit of juices, which are going to come out, and it's just going to be horrible.
The heavy pan is a big deal because you can only turn the burner up so much. Mm-hmm. You only get so much power out of that. But if you have that much heat built up in the heavy surface pan,
right. Well, that's another,
it's much easier to control.
That's another reason why, if you can afford even just two really good pans or three good pans, it's so worth it, because the heat conduction is so even and great, especially if it has a little bit, either it is a copper pan or it has a copper core to it, or, you know, it's just a good quality heavy pan, preferably lined with stainless steel for almost everything, for all uses, really. I mean, you can certainly use a cast iron pan or a steel pan, but
the other pan that's great, I think, for a lot of home cooks is a great big skillet that is ceramic lined.
Yeah,
but
that's
that is iron, and Staub and Kruse make them.
You just have to be careful with those, because that ceramic will chip off of there. So you really have to handle those carefully.
You can't be banging them around.
Right, right. But those will last forever.
And you can do tremendous work with them. That's so anyway, we're taking calls. We're live on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. 410-662-8780. Toll free is 866-661-9309. Or if you want to send us an email, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. And it's disasters. So take 1 minute, and what is your most recent, and I know you don't have a lot of them.
Not after cooking professionally for 31 years,
Let's hear a recent misstep that you had to fix on the fly.
Yeah, I honestly can't think of anything, but I will tell you that I recently made souffle, and I did not have a misstep, but I think one of the fascinating things about making souffle, and souffle is daunting for people that don't know how to cook, and we can talk about it a little bit further when we come back, but I did 8 different souffle dishes for 2 guests. I always make more than I should, because you never know what's going to happen with a souffle.
Bets.
Right. And 2 of them rose just in this gorgeous way, perfectly clean, straight sides. And then one of them kind of mushroomed. And it's just like, you know, it's all the same batter. Souffle is, I think, one of the most sort of fun. Well, first of all, we all love souffle. I don't know anybody that doesn't like souffle. Sweet dessert souffle. And I think it's a really fun way to really work on your cooking technique, because it really teaches you a lot of different elements of cooking by making them. So, and it doesn't cost much to make them at all. All you need are egg whites, egg yolks, a little milk, flour, and a tiny bit of butter, and some sort of other ingredient, whether it's Grand Marnier or chocolate or whatever you want to add to it.
Well, the discipline in it is the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's the detail orientation of, if you can do that, you can do an awful lot of things well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we're taking your calls, 410-662-8780. And I'm going to try to get a few kitchen disasters out of Chef Cindy Wolf, and happy to hear them from callers. If there's something you're struggling
with
making, or a recipe you can't follow.
Yeah, I think that's a good one to talk about, too. Recipes are daunting.
I'm perfectly happy to embarrass myself, Lord knows.
Oh, well, all right. So we look forward to that when we come back.
On WYPR.